This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. Every week, this program interviews journalists, activists, policy analysts, scholars, and others about the Israeli occupation and the U.S. support for it. It is our hope that every episode furthers understanding of Israel-Palestine. I am Jamie Jackson, the producer of this episode, Stories from Masafer Yatta. This area, also known as the South Hebron Hills, encompasses numerous small villages of olive growers and sheep herders who have been living under military rule for 55 years. In this episode, we hear Kifa Adera tell her story from Tuwani. In the 20 years since Kifa helped organize the women in Tuwani, they were able to realize some amazing accomplishments. This is a story of Sumud, resistance and steadfastness against violence by the military and by the illegal settlers. We also hear from two Americans who recently went to Masafer Yatta to support the Palestinians there. We begin with Kifa's story told to international and Israeli supporters who had gathered with her in Tuwani to celebrate the village's successes. I received a video recording of Kifa's presentation from George Ede, who unexpectedly passed away July 31st. May his memory be for a blessing. What is remembered lives on. Part 1, How a Women's Cooperative Started in Tuwani.
أنا لما بلشت أسست الجمعية في 2003 وبلشت في الفكرة ما كنتش يعني لي أصدقاء ولا بعرف حدا يساعدني في هالموضوع.
I started the Women's Cooperative in 2003. At first, I was alone. In the year 2000, at the start of the Second Intifada, we suddenly faced increased violence from settlers and the army. Our olive trees were cut down, our wells poisoned, and our crops burned. The situation became very difficult for us. In response to these increased attacks, some families moved away. So I began to think of how we women could strengthen the Sumud, the resistance against the occupation. Back then, women could not get an education here. Our opportunities were mainly craft work. So we decided to start a women's cooperative. But not everyone supported us. We found that we faced opposition from some of the men. The men's opposition was sometimes even harder. The occupation affects us all, but the men's opposition is the burden of the women. Anyway, women began joining the cooperative, and our numbers grew. Today, we number 36 women. Over time, we began to discuss other ways that we could work to benefit our community. What could we do to help our children? We started to think about their education and other training they should have. We decided to make it our goal to help girls go to university. Many girls here don't finish sixth grade or go on to high school. Today, we have women from our community who are studying in university. It's a huge improvement over what we had 20 years ago. And it was very important that we prepare our children to remain with us and learn how to resist the occupation, and learn to resist using nonviolent means. We used to take our kids out in the fields with us. I would take my kids, Salem and Bassem, into the fields where sometimes they would see their father and their uncle assaulted by settlers and by soldiers. We wanted them to learn by our example how to resist and deal with the occupation in a peaceful, non-violent manner. We said that it's not enough to have the company and solidarity of international activists. They must be the ones telling the world about the problems we face and about how we deal with them. And now, 20 years later, our kids are out front telling our story. Part 2, How Tuwani Got Electricity. Another issue we wanted to tackle was to bring in basic services like water and electricity. So in about 2004, we started to work on getting electricity to our village. Year after year, we went to the Israeli government. Each time, they threw another obstacle in our way. This went on for several years. And then in 2007, we had a visit from Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. He sat down and we told him about our ordeals, trying to get services and getting electricity to our community. And Mr. Blair said to us, "I promise you, in 2 months, you will have electricity." Mr. Blair left, and 2 months came and went. And then 2 years passed. Still, we had no electricity. We decided to do it ourselves. We had to work at night so no one would stop us. During the night, some of us did the work while others stood watch. Night after night we worked. Eventually, all the poles were up and the wires strung. Now, the last step was to connect to the main grid. This part was more complicated and presented extra challenges. One problem was that this last connection was in a place where we could easily be detected by settlers and the army, who passed near there frequently. So we were stumped. Then, one cold and rainy night, suddenly about 50 army vehicles stormed into the village. We all wondered, what were they up to? Were they about to demolish another home? Whose home? As we watched, they went to one of the poles and just took it down. Right away, everyone in the village, women, children, men, we all went to confront them. Among us were activists from America and Italy. They began filming the workers, and immediately their cameras were confiscated. The soldiers continued to pull up our poles, so some of our men started to block the way with large boulders. Then we heard the army commander give orders, "Arrest anyone moving boulders." Hearing that officer's order, we told the men to stop, and the women locked arms and formed a human chain. And with our children sitting in front of us, we sat blocking the way of the army's machines. The commander ordered the jeeps to move forward toward us, but we did not retreat. Each foot they moved forward, we also advanced toward them. Next, the commander ordered the drivers to rev their engines to choke us. But we weren't deterred. In fact, we welcomed the heat from the engines because it was such a cold night. Then the commander ordered two female soldiers to come forward toward the human chain of women and children and to beat us until we moved away. Those female soldiers approached us, brandishing their clubs, and we called out to them, "Why are you doing this? Can't you see we just want the same as you? Why should the chickens and the cows at the settlement over there have electricity and not us? What kind of crime do you think you are preventing?" Suddenly, one of the soldiers stopped. She said, "No, I won't do this. She knew it was wrong. And with that, she turned and walked away. After that, the soldiers loaded up the poles they had uprooted. They got in their vehicles and left the village. This incident brought us a lot of attention. And with that, as well as a lot of help from our activist friends in Israel, after about 2 months, we were connected to the grid. Part 3. After electricity, Sumud continues.
ولما اجت الكهرباء كانت اول يوم في رمضان يعني احنا حطينا الاكل بدنا ناكل يعني والكهرباء اجت لكل البيوت كل الناس بتركوا الاكل بيطلعوا
It was the first day of Ramadan when electricity came to Tuwani. We were just preparing for our iftar, and just when it was time to break our fast, the electricity went on all over the village. We all came out of our houses. It was so exciting. Some of the kids had never seen electricity, like my Bassem, who was 9 years old then. So we accomplished these things, not just through our own determination, but we also had a lot of outside help, especially from Ta'ayush, Israeli activists and others who stayed here and worked with our community. In the beginning, Ta'ayush brought other organizations to work with us. And then other women's groups approached us. They wanted to join the effort and work with us. I liked the idea, but I had to get consent from the others. I said to my neighbors that we should take advantage of contacts from outside. We don't want to return to how we were in 2000 when we were alone in our efforts. We should partner with outsiders so the world could see us. We decided to partner with them. Our local group worked with a designer here, and another designer worked with our partners in Israel. Things began to move along really well. We opened an outlet in Tel Aviv. Also, we had a manager, Rich Jones, who opened a store in New York. We became very busy here in Tuwani. And then COVID hit. We had formed strong bonds with our partners. Our relationships became friendships. We would all cook together and eat meals together. And to this day, I maintain a good friendship with my Israeli woman friend. We would go to parks and the beach together. It was really, really nice. Then, when COVID hit, the world shut down, and so did we. So I want you to know that we treasure every activist visitor who visits Tuwani and shows their support, and then returns to their own community and tells our story. As you and I know very well, real power is not found in weapons. It comes from our inner strength, which makes us stronger than anyone who carries a weapon. I want you to know how much it means to me for you to be here working with us. 20 years ago, we were just a few of us. We were just a few on our own, struggling with so many troubles. Today, you are here, and it warms my heart to see you all with us. Today, I feel more solidarity and support than I could have imagined 20 years ago. Thank you, thank you, thank you all. Shukran. You are listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. We turn now to hear Bob Souberi as he shares stories from his personal experiences and observations in Masafer Yatta. Bob lives in St. Louis, but he has gone to Masafer Yatta three times since 2019 to support the Palestinians.
While searching for groups online, I found the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, and I ended up choosing that organization because their delegations were centered around an action.
When was that?
That was in 2019-2020. We were in the South Hebron Hills, otherwise known as Masafer Yatta, which is south of Hebron, bordering the desert and the hills down there. And the action that the group was centered around was reclaiming a spring called Ain al-Beda, means the white spring, that Palestinians used to gather water for feeding their, mainly for feeding their livestock, sheep and goats. They historically would use that water for other purposes, either drinking or washing or whatever. That spring was taken over by a nearby illegal settlement called Avigayel, and they actually changed the name of the spring from Ain al-Beda to Avigayel, posted a sign, and wouldn't let the Palestinians anywhere near it. They would also use the spring for bathing, making it unclean.
And how many were in your group that were trying to help?
There were about 40, 45 people in our delegation. However, we were joined by other organizations, All That's Left, Tayush. There are a number of Israeli groups, activists, that joined in the action. And I would say there are about maybe 150 people there that were not Palestinian, but they're supporting the Palestinians a bit, you know, with their effort to reclaim their spring.
And you lived there for a few days, is that right?
Yeah, we lived there. I lived there for about 3 weeks. Mind you, I have family in Israel proper. I have, you know, fairly large family there. So I was living in Israel and also living in, well, the delegation was based out of a hotel in Bethlehem. So I was living in both places at the time.
So what was that like when you tried to reclaim the spring water?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, we actually got to see what's happening down there, you know, in terms of what happens when Palestinians try to claim their rightful access to their own land. And they, of course, the settlers showed up as soon as they changed the sign. They actually changed the sign that the settlers had put up and changed it back to the original name, or the Arabic name, Ain al-Beda. And the settlers showed up and tore down the sign. The army showed up, as they usually do, and started pushing back on the Palestinians. They generally do not push back on the settlers. They, you know, they'll use all sorts of means of, you know, pushing the Palestinians back. In this case, there were so many activists there that they were very moderate in, you know, the techniques they used to separate us.
Were the soldiers outnumbered?
Oh yeah, the soldiers were outnumbered, but I mean, you know, we're talking on, I mean, that doesn't, you know, they're all loaded to the hilt with, you know, assault rifles and grenades and tear gas, and, you know, nobody's going to challenge them on, you know, on a physical level.
But I just was trying to get a picture in my own mind of 150 volunteers and maybe a couple of dozen soldiers.
Yeah, what the volunteers were doing were things like cleaning up the spring, the trough that they built, you know, in order to provide water for their livestock was destroyed. And, you know, we were rebuilding that and cleaning up the entrance to the spring, making a path, you know, towards it. You know, it was an effort to reclaim the spring for the Palestinians. You know, we didn't expect this to last.
Make your statement, I guess, and give temporary relief.
Exactly.
But I'm trying to understand whether there was this one particular day when things came to a head. The settlers showed up, the soldiers showed up, the volunteers were there, Palestinians were there. Give us a battle description.
It was more of a demonstration than a battle. You know, we did not announce that we were going there. In fact, generally, the way the Center for Jewish Nonviolence operates is that their action will be kept a secret, even from the participants, even from the delegates, because the word gets out, and then the Israeli authorities, you know, the civil administration, the border police, and the IDF will be there and will prevent people from accessing the area where the demonstration is going to be. So this was done very, very quietly, and early in the morning we showed up and started reclaiming the spring. And, of course, you know, the typical modus operandi is the settlers show up, they call the police show up, the IDF shows up, and starts pushing the demonstrators back. There were so many people there, they were kind of in a tough situation with regards to how violent they could be. If there were 10 of us there, there would have been stun grenades and tear gas going off. And that's the modus operandi, and it's, you know, I've seen it happen time and time again whenever Palestinians and or progressives, you know, stand up for Palestinian rights and try to reclaim or assert Palestinian rightful ownership and use and access to their own land.
So you lived there for 3 months. Do you want to tell us what that was like?
Well, we got to see what happens down there, on a daily basis. I mean, you know, during the delegation the previous year, we were in and out. We'd go in for a few hours into the South Hebron Hills and then return to the hotel and talk about what we saw. But we didn't really interact that much with the Palestinians. During Hineni, we were actually living with them. We got to know them intimately. One of the main things we did was we accompanied Palestinians when they were shepherding, because that's when they were most vulnerable. We also accompanied them when they were working their fields, but their fields are fairly close to where they live. And although there was quite a bit of harassment while they were tending their fields, when they were shepherding, they were much further from their villages and much more vulnerable. And we got to see a lot of harassment and violence against Palestinian shepherds by settlers, by the IDF, and by the border police. This was particularly bad in an area called Jabal Dov. Jabal Dov is an area between the settlement of Havat Ma'on, which actually, by the way, is an illegal settlement that is known for their violence against Palestinians, and we encountered them time and time again. And so there was Havat Ma'on, and there was this small village called Tuba, and Tuba is a shepherding village. They pretty much rely on shepherding for their sustenance. And they have a lot of sheep, and the shepherds would graze on this area around Jabal Dov, which is an area, a mountain. Jabal means mountain. They're not really mountains, they're hills. And Dov was an Israeli, the name was given by settlers. He was an Israeli settler that died some time ago. There was constant harassment of shepherds. They would be grazing their sheep in the valleys, and then to go to the next valley, they would have to cross this ridge. And whenever they crossed the ridge, they would be attacked or confronted by settlers, sometimes with RVs driving through the herds. Sometimes stones would be thrown at them. Sometimes settlers would approach them with their own sheep, which they would disperse amongst the Palestinian sheep and then accuse the Palestinians of trying to steal their sheep. And every time there was one of these encounters, either the border police or the IDF or both would be called. They would come and disperse the shepherds and kick the Palestinian shepherds out of the area. And it became more and more difficult for them to graze their sheep. And so what happened was they ended up spending, I don't know where they got the money, but they spent tens of thousands of shekels on feed, on hay and barley and, you know, whatever they eat. And a week later, in the night, in the evening, settlers came and set it all on fire, burnt it all. I was there. I videotaped it. And so, again, they're just trying to make the settlers and the authorities, the Israeli authorities, are trained to make life so difficult for them that they leave.
And yet they don't leave.
Now we listen to Jim Haber talk about his experience.
So that was Friday the 10th, and it was to clear some boulders out of a road that had been the residence of an illegal outpost for Mitzpeh a year. They put these boulders in this road, and the Palestinians, these, 1,000 people, 10 or 12 villages, this road is needed by doctors and teachers and water trucks to get water in. This wasn't the first time that, I think Palestinians do organize boulder removal when they can. And this does happen sometimes on a smaller scale, but this was a larger day with, maybe 300 people, Israelis, Palestinians, internationals, not just us as internationals there that day, trying to do this, moving boulders. And the army was there, the police were there right away, and we did a little bit, but they also moved in and were very forceful. The police, they really pushed us very hard over a very rocky road. I got a very bad bruise on my left thigh. They used the tear gas and stun grenades. They pushed us up a road, and then at some point they were firing tear gas at us from afar, pushing us further back up the road. That road led us back towards the highway, a different place away from the outpost and away. They pushed us out of the way enough, and they didn't seem to really want to arrest us or anyone. They just wanted to make us go away.
But to be clear, the boulders were on land that Palestinians were supposed to be allowed to use. The boulders were put there by other people to keep them from using it, and yet the soldiers were not allowing you to remove the boulders.
From where the boulders were that we wanted to move. That's exactly right. Yes, they were being very violent to keep us from doing anything like that at all. And they were socializing casually with the people that put the boulders there in the first place.
You've been listening to Stories from Musafir Yatta. For more information, an excellent website is www.taayush.org. That's TAAYUSH.org. This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us again.